Hey, parents, go wake the kids because it's once again time for the Cinelux Hour. Did that sound convincing or no?
I would have said, hide your kids, hide your wife.
Yeah. That sort of, by the way, I wasn't expecting it, but that sort of underlines the whole artifice of this exercise. We record these intros whenever we get around to it after we've done the guest segments.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's like no point in pretending we don't know what's coming. I think it's beneficial for the audience because that way we don't ramble for 15 minutes. We actually get to our guests because mm-hmm. we know they have things to say. Yeah. In this instance, though, it's beneficial because one of the segments we're going to be doing is going to be about the whole Game of Thrones debacle, I think is a perfectly appropriate word for it. Mm-hmm. And the thread we've had on Cinelux about what compression did to help cause that. And as we had that conversation, we wanted to take some time to talk about your recent post about your really surprising results about, you know, people dump on Netflix, people dump on streaming in general, saying it's inferior quality or whatever. But tell the people what you found out.
Yeah, I mean, and I've had this conversation a lot with commenters on Home Theater Review where, you know, they're like, oh, gosh, I would rather watch a DVD than watch 4K on Netflix. And it's just garbage and it's artifacts. And I'm sitting here looking at an image that looks, in most cases, as good as a UHD Blu-ray. I mean, it's literally reference quality imagery. And they're like, oh, this is trash. And I'm just like, what is going on here? And then I stumbled upon something when I was comparing Netflix on my smart TV app versus my Roku Ultra app. And Roku Ultra is the way I do most of my streaming. And there wasn't a minor difference. There was a gigantic difference. The image from Netflix for coming off the Roku Ultra for our planet, literally I could stick my camera like 3 inches away from the TV and take a photo and you cannot find a video artifact. Whereas the app on my smart TV connected to the same network, connected via this, you know, cables to the same network switch, running the same speeds and everything, just looked like, you know, an old Real Player video. I would not have expected it to be that stark a difference, but it does make sense once you start thinking about how, you know, the very latest video codecs work and how processor intensive they are and how they are having to do an incredible number of mathematical calculations in numerous times a second instantaneously. And if you don't have the processing power there to do that, well, then the picture starts to look kind of poop.
Which, to cut right to the chase, means basically stop dumping on streaming and saying how awful it looks, because it's just not true. Think about the whole equation, but stop as a phenomenon in general and stop saying that Netflix looks awful, because Netflix looks amazing.
If anyone hasn't seen the article, just go look at the pictures. The pictures tell the entire story. Yeah. You know, you could see it with your eyes. One of those images is perfect. And one of those images looks like a swarm of bees. And they're like within a half second of each other of being the exact same content.
Yeah, you know? It's important to underline this is not an exercise in video file delusional subjectivity. You can prove it. You can back it up with indisputable, in the age of Photoshop, but indisputable photographic evidence.
Yep.
First segment is going to be with Andrew Robinson, who has been here before, Cinelux contributor. And so you know Andrew, but John Higgins is going to be joining us for the second segment. And Dennis, tell the folks something about John.
Ah, John is a dear friend. He's been a dear friend for a long time. He's also a writer for IGN and The Wirecutter. Great guy, and I'm glad to have him on talking about the Game of Thrones thing, because he's really the one who kickstarted this discussion for us, and he's also the one who is wrapping up the discussion.
Yeah, so looking forward to it. Jesus, we already did it. Looking back at it, it was a great experience. Let's put it that way. And before we, this is completely out of left field, and I'll probably end up cutting it out of the podcast, but yeah, I want these episodes to be professional. And I was thinking about it, you know, if you go into Adobe Audition, they they have a podcast filter in there that I could add to the tracks. Mm-hmm. It would make our voices sound deeper and more resonant.
Ooh, yeah. Let's get that.
Really? You want that? Do you think we need that?
I want to sound like Barry White, man.
We're going to sound like NPR. Everything we do from here on out is going to sound like Pledge Week. So, all right. So let's dive into it. This is going to be, I can tell you, all right, we can both guarantee this. This is the Mike and Dennis guarantee that this is going to be a great episode because we already know. We've looked into the future and we can promise that.
That's true.
So we're going to jump back in time in a moment and bring our guests in. And we're going to take the shortest of breaks and we'll be back on the other side with Andrew Robinson. See you then. All I got to do now is remember which thing we're talking about first.
Content creation.
Yeah. Okay, so let's jump right into it. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you.
Okay, and we're going with this part of the episode because we sort of hinted at it the last time you were here, and I just wanted to dive in a lot deeper, if we can. It seems as if, I mean, people are taking Netflix serious as a movie studio now. And it's happening with Amazon. And just a few years ago, people were laughing at that whole premise. They said, you can only do series, you'll never be able to do real movies. That's happening. It's also stealing, you know, a lot of attention from movie theaters, whatever. So that's all changing. But is Netflix really doing anything content-wise that much different than what we're used to seeing in movie theaters or on series television?
You know, it's funny. I actually don't think it is. I think what Netflix is doing is a little more than what TV and film studios were able to do years ago. The only thing that Netflix has, in my opinion, that it benefits from is it has come along with an entire generation of viewers that are okay with accepting the screen, their laptop, their phone as a suitable viewing device. That's number one. And number two, they know their revenue going in. So they actually can predict like what their budgets are and how much they can do and what things might perform for them. And it gives them a little bit more freedom to commit to longer term projects or to certain talent or to this or that. Whereas, you know, a film studio, barring a Marvel movie, you know, producing or funding a project and spending 2 or 3 years on it is a bit of a crapshoot. You know, you could put $140 million into a project and make $15 million of it back. Netflix has a stable revenue stream that comes into them every month.
Yeah.
But I do think that ends up in some worthwhile risk-taking. I mean, look at Love, Death, Robots. You know, David Fincher tried to get that made for 12 years in Hollywood. I really wanted to make that for, you know, studio theatrical release, and just nobody could make the numbers work. Nobody believed in it. No, you know, it just, well, so I will say with things like that, I mean, yeah, you could say it's they're tweaking the traditional model, but I do think there's some value in the fact that they can take risks that Hollywood won't. You know.
Well, and I think, though, too, if David Fincher was honest with himself with respect to Love, Death, and Robots, no one was going to make that movie. I mean, yeah. David Fincher has a hard enough time getting his normal stuff made. And so, ooh, yeah, the heavens didn't like that comment. But yeah, it's just, it's one of those things where I think the reason why Netflix and the like have garnered now a reputation for being able to take risks is because in the beginning, they had to say yes to a lot of projects that were on blacklists or hadn't been taken by the studios. And when those became successful, then all of a sudden they look like real innovators.
Yeah.
But they very easily could have gone the other way, in which case Hollywood would have pointed to them and go, see, this is why we don't make that stuff.
Yeah.
And Netflix would have been relegated to being basically a streaming version of the straight-to-DVD bin at Walmart.
Can you see them hitting a wall sometime relatively soon? Where can they take this innovation-wise to keep it fresh.
I do think that they are addressing and or are grappling with success now and looking at it much more long-term. They've proven to themselves and to others that they are a viable force, but just like any studio or television production, they don't want to overdo it. And as a result, I think they're being more selective. You're seeing them be more selective. And the other thing that Netflix is doing smartly is they are opening up dramatically to foreign markets, because I mean they're welcoming Indian cinema, South African cinema, mm-hmm. In a big way, to the point where there are times where I'm looking through Netflix content, you know, and I'm not recognizing anything. But then I'll jump on IMDb or something, look up a title and realize that that movie was their Avatar, you know, pick your country, but that was their biggest grossing, whatever. And Netflix understands that their audience is more than just teenage white girls and middle-aged men. They are global. And that's very smart, because they're becoming the location for where to get that content anywhere. And, right. And that's a really big deal, because if, depending on whatever those contracts are and those agreements are, when Hollywood needs that content too, in order to stay alive, it may put Netflix in a very, very advantageous bargaining or value proposition.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing that Netflix is doing that's interesting with that content is it's just, and you alluded to this a little bit, Andrew, it's just sort of presented as, well, this is a thing to watch. Whereas in the past, it's always sort of, let's put this over in the Indian corner, and let's put this over in the African corner. And this is a thing that if you have this really weird special interest, you can check that out. Whereas on Netflix, it's like, hey, here's a show, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
And I think that's kind of compelling.
And that gets to the democratization of content, in the sense that, you know, Hollywood panders to foreign markets because they need China, they need India, they need the Middle East to offset the sheer costs these projects now take. And as a result, you see that pandering in the content itself. I mean, Independence Day 2, crap movie. I'm not sitting here trying to stand up for it, but it's just the number one thing that came to my head just right off the rip. But I haven't seen a film pander that hard to, hey, by the way, thank you, China, for, you know, $100 million of our $240 million budget. We're going to make sure that Jeff Goldblum drinks, you know, Chinese moon milk or whatever it's called. And it just, some of these ways that they're incorporating the foreign markets seem so heavy-handed, and just they take you out of it. Whereas Netflix is just, yeah, like you said, it's content.
Yeah,
it's just content. And as a result, like, I find myself, I've watched a couple of European, like Swedish and Denmark series, you know, Denmark based productions. Wow, their cinematography is great.
I've been getting into some Korean stuff that it's just,
oh Korea's been killing it.
It's amazing, you know? Yeah. Korea's where I never would have stumbled across it before. It's not that I had anything against it. It's just that that was never sort of put in front of me as, hey, this is a different thing and maybe you should check it out. Whereas with Netflix, it's just like, hey, you might like this.
Yeah.
Korean soap opera, really? Holy crap, pop the popcorn. You know, it's, yeah. It's,
yeah. There's a Korean action film called The Tower that I argue was remade by The Rock in Skyscraper. And
just Tower, not well.
Yeah, not well, but The Tower is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Whereas Skyscraper is not. That's the beauty, I think, of Netflix, in the sense that from a original content standpoint, you know, they've proven that they're a viable force. I also think that Netflix has technology on their side and a better platform to showcase that technology even more so than theaters. Netflix has some of the most stringent standards to get content on their platform now. That mm-hmm. didn't used to be the case, but now it is. And as a result, stuff that's being produced for Netflix, by Netflix or whatever, is arguably better than what some cinematic productions are able to allow for. And with 8K emerging, I hate this that I'm saying this out loud, but with 8K emerging sooner than expected and displays like that, the first companies that are going to be able to take advantage of this are the streaming companies, specifically Netflix. And when you become the source of content for people to be able to enjoy their technology that they've paid for, I mean, that's huge. That makes Netflix so much more of a Trojan horse for everything and a gateway for everything. I mean, Netflix was at 4K streaming and 4K HDR before disc was.
So that essentially means they're well positioned to both take down the studios and the cable networks.
They are, but I could see someone like a Disney just buying them.
True.
to keep that from happening.
Well, actually, that sort of provides a opportunity to pivot this a little bit, because it seems like most Netflix content fits within traditional molds, right?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of innovation going on there with form or what's being captured or how it's being expressed. They're not doing anything. They're relying primarily on traditional genres.
They are. Black Mirror does differ in the sense that they are experimenting with that programming in the sort of choose your own adventure.
Kind of like the old Sega CD, CD yeah. adventures, where it's like, it's choose your own video experience kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I do think that you take that choose your own adventure approach with the advent of AR and VR, Netflix, that's where I believe the new frontier for them and for content creation that breaks with tradition. I think we'll always have tradition, but there is bound to be a merging of cinema and video games, and it's going to come in the form of streaming. And you're seeing it a little bit with like Black Mirror, and then you're seeing it with AR, VR, then you're seeing it obviously with the popularity of gaming. And all three of those things are going to kind of coalesce into a virtual space, in which case we are not going to watch our content anymore. We're going to walk around in it. We're going to inhabit the film. And that is infinitely interesting, because that is going to give credence to the home entertainment market anew in ways that we've never seen.
I will say this, though, Mike, to your point, I honestly think I've gotten into the habit of thinking of Netflix as my avenue for mass market entertainment. That's not where I watch the weird stuff. That's not where I watch the niche stuff. That's where I go for just the normal stuff. It's normal stuff done really, really well.
Instead of being coy about it, let's just go right to the heart of it. Could Critical Role have developed organically within Netflix?
No. Why? well, for one thing, it looks like a really high class version of public access, which I don't think Netflix would allow, because they do.
I'm talking about going back to their origins as just sort of sitting around a kitchen table. Would Netflix allow that kind of presentation?
I don't think so. And I mean, even Legendary with Geek and Sundry tried not to allow it. They really wanted to change. They tried to commercialize Critical Role out of the gate. These guys had their game, their Dungeons and Dragons game they were playing. Felicia Day saw it, said, "You guys have got to start filming this." And as soon as Legendary heard that, they immediately went into ways that they could commercialize it. Okay, so you could do your role-playing thing, but then when you fight, we're going to have you switch over to video game monitors. And they were like, "Nope, that's not what we want to do." So even in that sort of wild west of Twitch, the commercial interest had tried to change it into something it wasn't. And they had to fight really hard to keep it what it was. So there's no way it would have survived on something like Netflix.
So I guess the point I'm reaching for here is obviously Critical Role has gone mainstream in the sense that a lot of people are aware of it now. Mm-hmm. It's got a pretty big audience. But what is that mainstream? If it's not Netflix mainstream, what is that thing? And is that the place where we can expect to see innovation?
I don't know. What do you mean by innovation?
Well, that's non-traditional programming.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. You know, the MST3K reboot ended up on Netflix because it was a known quantity. Yeah. The original show never would have stood a chance.
No.
From the very way it was conceived and executed and the way it built an audience, that's totally antithetical to the Netflix model. So looking at that as a precursor, Critical Role is like a latest manifestation of it. What is that thing? Is that alternative programming? And if it is alternative programming, it seems damn close to the mainstream. And if that's true, then where is its home going forward?
I think, though, that that's a consequence of the fact that, and this is a conversation we've had time and time again, there's almost no such thing as mainstream anymore. So, a couple of weeks ago, I watched this thing on Hulu that was a live broadcast, a live interpretation of an episode of All in the Family from, 46 years ago. They just took a 46-year-old script and did it live with the new cast. And in the intro to that, they mentioned something about the fact that, during the course of the week, some hundreds of millions of people watched the show, 144 million or something like that. And that blew me away. 144 million people. Whereas today, if 3 million people watch something, oh my God, it's mainstream. You know, our idea of mainstream has completely changed because not everybody's watching the same.
Well, is mainstream the delivery platform then? Because you were saying before that Netflix is mainstream to you.
Yeah.
The sheer aggregate of numbers watching it that makes it mainstream, not necessarily any particular show on it, right?
I guess so, yeah. I guess so. And Andrew, also production values, values,
yeah,
you know, pre-scripted stuff, you know, very planned and written and edited and things like that, that, you know, I guess gives it the air of mainstreamness to some degree, but yeah, it's not an easy thing to put your finger on.
But I think what the quasi argument you guys just raised is that mainstream denotes, like you said, a certain production value, foresight, of that nature, something of that nature, where it has to appear in a format that is digestible. In it can't it can be new, it can be different, but it still has to have a toe or two in what we're used to, in order for it to be deemed A, quality, B, mainstream, or any combination of those two things. And in that respect, then I think the largest platform for innovation has been and continues to be YouTube. And the reason why I say that is because there are individuals putting up numbers that honestly, any network on a Thursday night between four episodic shows wishes they had.
Yeah.
And they're doing it in minutes, not in hours, days, weeks, months, years, and seasons. They're literally doing it in the span of about 15 minutes. And when you look at that, you realize that the entire conversation that we're having right now is antiquated by nature, because this isn't moving the needle. A 9-year-old kid that has figured out that going and opening toy boxes moves the needle. And they're creating storytelling around that. And what's even more hilarious is that the few times, or the handful of times, that the mainstream has come for those creators to bring them into the fold, they, I think, have unanimously failed and have returned back to YouTube, because that is not what the audience is clamoring for.
Right.
And what's even more funny too, is there are a number of very high profile content creators that are slowly positioning themselves to try and move into the mainstream, a la, by living in LA, trying to find more commercialized projects and things of that nature, whereas you have known quantities in the mainstream, your Will Smiths, Tom Cruises, and things like that, flocking to YouTube as fast as possible. in the same way that movie stars are flocking to Netflix and things of that nature because of the quote, the seemingly meatier roles, the more notable content.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're either in a superhero movie on the big screen or you're on Netflix. But I think the really smart performers, writers, directors are also looking at YouTube and going, now I have full, I use full in air quotes, but I have control of not only my image, but the monetization of it and the storytelling that I want to tell. And in a weird way, vlogs are episodic movies of creation.
Yeah, that's something I want to try to wrap the segment up by trying to pull some of the threads together. And if this is mm-hmm. going too far in the wrong direction, just stop me. But a real world example of that is, you know, I mentioned the MST3K reboot, the whole Kickstarter campaign went on to Netflix. I consider it a complete disaster. You know, it's just, there's nothing there I haven't seen before. I don't find any of it amusing. It feels like a forced exercise to me. But when they were doing the Kickstarter campaign, they did a 4-hour telethon at the end of it. And it was live, and it was like everybody from the show, and it was Patton Oswalt and all these people on there. And then I'm forgetting the name of Dana Gould and all these other people. And everything technically went wrong that could have gone wrong on there. And it's one of the most entertaining things I've seen in years because it's seasoned professionals reacting to disaster in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time that was going on, Felicia Day did a live stream concurrent with the telethon where she interacted with what was going on there. All of that was far more entertaining than what they did with the series. And I think that could be a model for content creation going forward, more mainstream people getting into essentially working without a net,
mm-hmm.
which also gets into the thing you're talking about of vlogging, but also people being in the middle of the action and that becoming the narrative and the drama.
Yeah.
I see it as a viable form, and I think it's almost inexhaustible. There are so many different ways to play that out, and I think we're just at the beginning of that.
Oh, I would absolutely agree. I mean, we have no better example of the merging of YouTube or the emergence of YouTube into everyday culture than something that happened just, 2 weeks ago. And it surrounded the makeup community. But I turned on CNN, and, you know, 2 weeks ago, and they are covering a vlog feud on the nightly news, a vlog feud that is spilling over out of YouTube. It made newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, and all of this thing, because you are talking about hundreds of millions of views, hundreds or thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in gained, lost revenue. You're talking about subscriber counts that fluctuated in the tens of millions overnight. And it became a thing that, no joke, I was at a outdoor shopping mall here in Austin going to dinner. And I walked by a table where there were four people sitting at that table. And I assume that it was a mother, her young daughter, grandmother, and maybe a friend. And all four of them were having a conversation about this feud on YouTube. And if you had looked at any one of these four women, including the young girls, you wouldn't sit there and say for 1 second that they would have any concept of what you were talking about. And yet here they were, are you team this or you team that?
Yeah.
And that's what social media has created in our entertainment and communication landscape, is it's made it possible not only for Monday morning quarterbacking and for everyone's opinion to quote unquote be heard, but you feel a part of what you're engaged in. And
Dennis and I were talking about this before. It's no longer the idea of something being handed down to you.
No, you're not passive. Yeah. You go to a movie, you're a passive participant. You are watching something that has been predetermined for you. YouTube, you're watching something that is unfolding with you, and based, you may even have a comment or insight and or the ability to change it.
Imagine getting to the point where you're sophisticated enough that you can jump into the narrative as it's playing out. You were an unanticipated factor, and you spin it off in a whole new direction.
I mean, we're literally there. One of the YouTube news broadcasts that I watch, the Phil DeFranco show, I watch them every day, and it's, you know, basically 15 minute breakdown of the day's news. While he was recording his vlog, he kept having to interrupt himself because, oh, well, president said this and this just happened. And now YouTube is responding with this comment. And he's literally got a live tweet, Twitter feed in the, you know, the window next to him. Cause as he's talking, YouTube is replying to him in real time.
Yeah.
And it's like, holy crap, you are literally watching news happen instead of, well, this happened just 10 minutes ago. No, it's like literally he said something and some representative of YouTube was watching as he said it and said, well, hold on a second, you know? And that happens a lot. That happens a lot. And the more it happens, the more people feel engaged. And that is how some of these influencers are reaching kingmaker status.
Yeah, but we got to wrap this up so we can bring John in. But I just want to throw one last thing out there about it, which is, what the hell was I going to say about it? Oh, yeah, it seems, you know, it's easy to get cynical and say this could quickly become repetitive and everybody waving their arms and saying me too. And, you know, just accentuating the inherent narcissism of the exercise. But it's, to me, it seems like the potential being much more vital than any other genre we've got going right now. And I think if we can get beyond paying attention to just individuals in that landscape and make it more about groups interacting. And like I said, the, you know, the idea of these overlapping narratives, you know, this is playing out with this group and then suddenly it intersects with this other group and it goes off in some completely unanticipated direction. And like, it's the idea of working without a net, like how inventive and entertaining can you be when you throw you literally threw the script away?
Well, and I do think that it's a bit of an oversimplification to say that YouTube is a bit of a narcissistic exercise, because the one thing YouTube does that a lot of mainstream media, even the progressive mainstream media like Netflix and whatnot, it has given voice and created communities and groups of the disenfranchised for good and for bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to deny that YouTube is a haven for hate speech. It is a haven, you know, for really, really bad conspiracy theorists and stuff that's just truly vile. But it is also the only safe space that a lot of people have and not feeling isolated.
Well, that's, I think, part of the price you have to pay to have that.
Right.
Yeah, there's definitely more I want to talk about here, but I think we haven't sent an invitation to John yet, so let's get him in on this and let's shift over to compression and then hopefully revisit this another day. Okay?
Sounds good.
Great. Okay. See you on the other side.
Okay. All right, we're out. Do you want to send John the invite?
I just sent it to him.
Okay, I was wondering about that. Okay, should we jump in?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back and we're going to talk about compression, which 6 months ago we probably wouldn't be devoting a segment to, and now everybody knows about it, and everybody knows about it because of Game of Thrones. And when John Higgins, who's joining us for the first time, hi John.
Hello.
Wrote about that, we got a great response on the site and it triggered a really nice thread. So John is now going to be doing a post about the lessons everybody learned from that experience. So John, why don't you walk us through some of what we learned and what's been addressed and what we can expect not to see fixed anytime soon.
Right. So it's, as you mentioned, it's interesting that we're now talking about compression. You know, we've been talking about it in the industry for years. This isn't a new issue, but it is definitely more apparent when 17 million people see it on one of the most highly anticipated events of the past couple years, really. So there are a few things that we see. One is compression and the different codecs that are being used and how well they handle compression or don't. There was a sort of blame cycle that happened with the cinematographer of Game of Thrones, where one of the things he blamed, in addition to the compression, was essentially the viewers and the fact that they don't watch properly on their TVs. Then there's also something that Dennis actually touched upon in an article, in that the app that you're using and, more interestingly, the device that the app is on could have a dramatic effect on the image quality that you're seeing. There's also the viewing time, when you're actually watching it and how many of your millions of friends are watching it with you, how that affects the bandwidth coming from either the internet or your service or however you're watching it. And then there's been a trend recently over the past few years. It's not a new concept, but it seems to be happening more in low light cinematography. So instead of a large amount of light being shown, a large amount of additional light, I should say, being shown on a scene in order to make sure that you can see all of the detail of the characters and the set and anything, there's now been the use of mainly natural light that makes the situation, I guess, more realistic and more intimate. And when you have an episode like that Game of Thrones episode, which was 82 minutes, I believe, of night and very dark scenes where only, or at least the majority of light was coming just from sources like the fires that were happening or the natural moonlight that was happening, that it makes it more difficult sometimes to see those shadow details. And if you have the compression on top of that or an older television that has higher black levels, those issues can be exacerbated by the fact that it's a very low light situation that it was filmed in.
John, I wanted to go back to something that you just briefly said there, because I think you touched on probably one of the most important issues. Different forms of compression. I have conversations a lot with so-called videophiles online who just don't understand the different types of compression work in different ways. And they boil everything down to, well, this has more bits, and so therefore it is better, ignoring the fact that some types of compression don't require nearly as much data. So I think one of the things that is probably coming up in people's minds, if they realize it at all, is that no matter how you watched Game of Thrones, that episode, you were watching it via an older, more out-of-date form of compression. If you were watching it via HBO streaming apps, you know, an older form of compression. If you were watching it via cable or satellite, an even older form of compression than that. And I think a lot of people just don't realize that those older types of compression work in a completely different way than the newer forms. And that, you know, even if they do have a lot more bandwidth behind them, they don't necessarily look as good. So I'm at least happy that we're having that conversation now, that what type of compression you use matters. So,
right. And the interesting thing that I want to touch upon that you bring up is when you're watching it over cable or satellite, you're not just watching when HBO delivers the content to the content provider, they have it compressed. They're using H.264 compression or AVC compression, but the cable company is compressing it again.
Yeah.
So there's compression on compression that's happening for them to get it across their signal as well. You got to figure, you know, cable companies have a high bandwidth, but they're sending you hundreds of channels mm-hmm. that are all compressed. So you're not getting just HBO at their only bandwidth. Everything is being sent down the line, whether you watch it or not, it's going to you. But yeah, these older codecs, like 264 is from getting close to 20 years ago, 16 or 17 years ago is when we first saw it, when it first came out and was first starting to be implemented. Even though it didn't really become the codec until about 6 or 7 years ago, mm-hmm. 7 or 8 years ago.
And then, you know, 3 years ago, HEVC, H.265 became the codec, but there's still a lot of people not using that, you know?
Right. So it is the it became the better codec, yeah. but it wasn't being implemented as well because like they can encode it in 265, but it still needs to be decoded when it gets to you. Yeah. So it's the problem with fast moving technology, right? Is that there's always going to be a limit of the hardware before you're able to get the software to work properly.
And then there are newer forms like AV1, which are going to be even more efficient, but you know, take time to develop. So,
right. Yeah. That came out last year and it is even better as far as its bitrate requirements than HEVC, but it's not ready for everyone yet. Like we need the adoption to happen both from the people that are sending the signals. And then on top of that, we need it from how we're receiving those signals.
Let me shift the discussion slightly to Dennis's piece. Cause you know, there's still, and I've had this conversation within the past week, people who still dump on streaming in general is streaming's bad and it's always compromised. And your piece was, it doesn't need to be, there are certain factors that play into it. And is it fair to say, had that episode been shown on Netflix, we wouldn't be having this conversation?
And that may be the case. It's probably the case, yeah.
Yeah, so, I think that's the case. And also,
explain
not just because Netflix.
Listenership, why that's so.
I think two things. I think Netflix has a higher standards of video and audio quality presentation. And I think what's more, they you know, one of the things I think a lot of people don't realize is that when you're watching Netflix, you're probably not streaming from some remote server. You're probably getting that content from a server that's relatively close to you. Netflix sort of decentralizes their distribution. So, you may be streaming your Netflix. I may be getting it from Atlanta and John is getting it from LA and things like that.
How does that compare to the cable model? Because John, you were just mentioning that they're streaming all the channels simultaneously. We're delivering all the channels simultaneously.
From my understanding, there are centralized hubs of servers for the cable services as well. It's not like we're all getting them from Des Moines or something. Honestly, one of the interesting things that about Netflix that it sort of endears them to me is they are really transparent with what they're doing.
Oh yeah.
They actually have the Netflix tech blog where they cover issues that they deal with and that they deem to be important. And whereas you come across HBO or any like Time Warner or Spectrum or whoever you're using dependent upon your area, they don't really want you to know what's happening. At least that's the impression they give. They don't want to show you the man behind the curtain. They'd rather you guess or just, you know, blind faith.
Okay, to add another broad stroke to the conversation. So HBO, it's partly the compression they're using. It's partly the fact that they're a cable network, right? So basically this happened because it's kind of an antiquated form, whereas Netflix is not.
Yeah,
is that fair?
I think that's fair. Or they're coming from an old mindset at the very least. You know, cable always has to cater technologically to the lowest common denominator because they want their content to be seen. It's one of the same reasons that, you know, it took forever for them to get on board with sound as well. You know, I mean, we don't have really Dolby Atmos coming from cable companies. We're limited to our Dolby Digital feeds. And even though HBO has gone on to have these streaming platforms, their mentality is 100% still mired in cable.
I think that lowest common denominator comment is right on the nose, and that is a beautiful way to put it. You know, and I think to sort of illustrate the difference, you know, when Netflix went to 4K HDR streaming, they basically said, okay, if you want this, you're going to have to get a new device that can decode HEVC. I mean, can you imagine cable companies doing that? You know, this new innovation we're going to do, you got to replace all your hardware. Netflix is nimble. They can do that. The cable companies just can't.
Well, but they also choose to do that. Hulu offered 4K quietly for a little while and then just as quietly got rid of it because they didn't want to deal with it anymore.
Yeah.
So it's still not dependent upon cable versus streaming. It's I guess they're scared. You know, they don't want to lose viewers. Whereas Netflix is, they know, or at least their belief is, we have amazing content. You want to come to us, but if you want to, here are the requirements. Mm-hmm. I my hope is that HBO will take a lesson from this and change the way that they view things a little bit, and understand that more and more people are going streaming. I mean, cable's not dead. Satellite isn't dead. It's not going to be dead for a little while, but they need to take into account the millions of people that are getting them through streaming.
And I think another thing that plays into this is just the fact that quality performance is getting to be so attainable now. You know, I mean, we can, with very little budget, build an entertainment system that delivers, you know, impeccable visual and audio quality. And I think people have just come to expect and assume that that's going to be there. And so when something like the Game of Thrones debacle happens, they're just like, wait a minute, all of a sudden this thing is not living up to the excellence of my, you know, $500 TV anymore.
And so, I think that's one of the reasons why that argument doesn't really have a lot of weight to it. Mm-hmm. Is yes, you can get a $500 TV that looks really good. I mean, obviously it's not going to be as good as a $2,000 to $3,000 OLED. It's not.
No.
But it's not going to be terrible. Mm. And it is going to show the issues more when they come up. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened in that episode, with millions of people watching at the same time with an older codec that couldn't handle the compression. It just, that squeeze on the bandwidth.
Also the delivery platform, the flaws in the cable delivery method.
Right. I mean, that it all leads back really to the bandwidth that you need to see it properly. And if that bandwidth gets squeezed in any way, you know, it's, you can't force an apple down a garden hose without losing some of the apple.
Well, I have to chime in, because I do think that some of the onus is on the content creators themselves, because it's not a surprise what the delivery methods are. Game of Thrones has been around for 8-9 years. They know how this is being viewed. They know where it's going, how it's getting there. And that was hubris, stone cold hubris on behalf of the camera department, DIT, post-production, in thinking for 1 second that you could film a 90-minute episode in natural light at night and think you were going to get any other result than what happened. Because I'm sorry, even if that had appeared on Netflix, it was black. You want to try and compress black and retain any sort of detail? What is the compression hanging on to? There was no contrast in that image to begin with. Even shooting in RAW with the Arri Alexa, which is what they use, you're talking about 14 stops of dynamic range. Well, 14 stops of dynamic range is implied when the lights are on, when the sun's out. There's no 14 stops of dynamic range in the middle of the freaking night. And for them to think that there was going to be a different outcome is a little bit, there was a little blame to be put on that. And I think it is a little bit lazy. And I think that we're seeing a natural, you know, this natural light craze, which has been kind of spurred on by the DSLR and the CMOS sensor revolution, because back in the early days of digital cinema, when things were CCD, CCD-based sensors, everyone understood that, yeah, it's digital, but you have to expose it the same as you do as film, because these sensors are not light sensitive. You know, the fastest ISO you can have is potentially 800, which is not good for nighttime shooting. But more and more of these CMOS sensors, all of which are pretty much manufactured by Sony, is putting this false sense of security into people's eyes. And we're seeing a new generation of cinematographers even coming out of training programs and schools that think, It's about depth of field and lenses and to hell with light. I'm a natural. I'm avant-garde. I'm this, I'm that. No, you got to light the shit. And compression makes that all the more apparent, because even if, I'm not saying shoot all this stuff day for night, but had it, I mean, I saw the documentary, the behind the scenes documentary, which oddly enough did not show a lot of footage from that particular episode. If you watch the 2-hour Game of Thrones documentary, there was not a great deal of coverage focused on that particular episode. But look at the scenes that happened in the tombs or the crypt or whatever. Same at night, still dark, still scary, still this, still that, and yet not nearly the same problems. And that's because it was lit while still remaining natural in its appearance and dark. And I don't know if that was an issue of weather. I can't imagine it being budget. It's Game of Thrones. But a couple more condor cranes with some blimps up there simulating moonlight likely would have made a difference. And after an 8-9 years on the show, to think for 1 second that you're going to up and blame the delivery system. You know what it was. It hasn't changed in a decade.
Yeah.
Dennis and I talked about this the other day. My question is, what did HBO think when they received the file? I mean,
their file looked brilliant. They're getting the master file. So,
right. Who's responsible for, at the end of the day, for guaranteeing what you're seeing at home within the whole chain of operation? Who's most responsible?
Oh, man. Okay. Wow, I don't know if there's an answer to that question. You know, it passes through so many hands, each of which has their own agenda, you know, and ultimately it gets to,
I mean,
the cable companies and things like that, and their agenda is save as much money as possible, crank as much
stuff. Well, this may be a bad analogy, but if a print shows up at a movie theater and you're the theater owner and run it and you realize nobody can see this movie, then you got a decision to make whether you're going to show that film or not. You have to guarantee that they have something to see.
Well, as someone that was a projectionist, if they can't see it, I guess you can refund their ticket and call home office and hope. But I think at the end of the day, by the time it hits your streaming service, you're so low man on the totem pole that, I mean, what got turned over from the edit bay to whatever digital technician is responsible for the disseminating of that episode, whatever got turned over was likely not only visible, but of a very high quality. I do not imagine that anyone inside the Game of Thrones camera department is responsible for the down convert. I think they turn over master files if it's not DCI quality or, you know, similar or comparable, then something happened inside another post facility, most likely in Los Angeles. But again, if it looked fine on the master tape, but you're at the borderline of the capability of the technology because you chose to shoot it a certain way, then you have nowhere to go.
Right.
Whereas if they had perhaps overexposed it so that they had all that digital information to then compress, we may be having a different conversation. And that is the delicate dance that filmmakers have to now contend with and play with in today's digital age. And, you know, there's a lot of cinematographers that are like, well, people don't calibrate their TVs. They don't do this. They don't do that. Let's just assume they're never going to. Okay. Like, This has never been a thing. It's not like 20 years ago people did this and they've just all of a sudden decided to stop. People cannot be bothered. And no one is more evident of that than enthusiasts themselves. They don't want their TV calibrated. They want a bigger one. They don't want to fix the bass response in their theater. They want another subwoofer. And so if you know that going in, you can do things on the creative side that make their experience better. And lo and behold, when you do that, shockingly, they actually really appreciate it. And that's why I think there's a little bit of DP hubris involved here besides the limitations of the technology?
Yeah, is this kind of like the Titanic? I mean, we're such a big show, we can sort of force whatever we want to down people's throats. We're invulnerable with this, whereas a smaller production never could have even gotten away with going there.
I think that probably has part of it.
I mean,
part to do with it.
I don't,
there is nobody that is guilt-free in this situation. So I don't want to say that it's only HBO's fault, it's only the DP's fault, it's only the viewer's fault. But this also isn't the first time we've seen compression artifacts with Game of Thrones. It's happened before. They've had dark scenes. The problem is it was an hour and a half of dark scenes and an hour and a half of compression artifacts.
Yeah. And if anything, it does shed light and show, you know, the issue that is upon us.
Right.
And that's the good thing.
I know this is pure speculation, but what do you think the majority of people took from this experience? Did they see it as an anomaly, or did they see it as symptomatic, or what? What is, are people taking action? Are they rethinking anything, or was it just, hey, that happened, it's over?
I think most people just think it was too dark. I honestly think the average consumer was like, yeah, they shot it with the lights off. You know, it's probably what most people think. They just, you know, they should have turned a light
on. I have to wonder, from a creative standpoint, is it going to change anything? Absolutely not. We are literally rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. It's not important. But from a creative, subconscious, psychological standpoint, up until that point, people were pretty like psyched about the story. Like, nothing too egregious has occurred. It's very anticipatory. Did that set off the hate watch? Did that episode ignite the vitriol that then could only go in? The only direction it could go was down. And had that episode not had those technical problems, would people not have been as vehemently opposed to the final season as they ultimately ended up being? And is this an instance where the technology has now influenced the art?
Yeah, on a subliminal level, you sort of shut the audience out of the show.
Yeah. And did you give them a bad experience so that in the event of episode 4, they're coming into it from a place of, well, how dare you? You messed up. You owe me something. They're coming into the story from a standpoint of being owed an explanation, or owed a bigger, better arc, or a bigger, better reveal, or something. And which case you can't deliver. And then now you have 2 episodes in a row, and then a 3, and then a 4, to the point where people get to the final episode. Like, you know, when I was watching it with my fiance, the final episode hadn't even started yet. And she turned to me, and she's a bigger Game of Thrones fan than I am. And she's like, I don't even care. I just don't even care. I'm going to finish it because I've spent 8 years watching it thus far, but I don't even care. And can you trace that attitude back to that episode?
It's an interesting, could be.
I mean, this played out on a massive scale. I wouldn't rule it out.
I could definitely see it having some effect, but the writing was also pretty suspect.
There's that
season or two. Yeah, I think I also think it's hard to deliver on the promise that they made, especially over a limited amount of time. They should have taken more time to tell it, in my opinion.
Yeah, and now everyone gets to see what they do with Star Wars. So if you're a fan of Star Wars, good luck.
Well, luckily that fandom is completely reasonable.
Oh. Okay, let's wrap it up. We're going to take a short break and be back in a moment. We're out. So we're back, and we're going to do what we usually do, which is go around the horn and see what everybody's experienced recently, stuff you've watched, listened to, or just done you think other people might want to hear about. John, how about you? Do you want to start with Chernobyl or something else?
That is at the forefront of my mind. And it's interesting because it's HBO too, right?
Yeah. Artifacts, right?
And yeah, there were still some artifacts, but we also are looking at like just touching 1 million people viewing at once as opposed to 17 million.
Yeah.
It is, for those that don't know, because apparently a lot of people were unaware of the series, it sort of overlapped with the end of Game of Thrones as far as its broadcast goes. It is a retelling, a dramatic retelling of the Chernobyl disaster, and it is haunting and amazing and terrifying in so many ways, primarily because it actually happened and you're watching. It's a 5-episode disaster movie. It's really incredible to watch. The acting is great. You'll start hearing some Emmy buzz about it, I'm sure. For me as a musician, the score was perfect. It incorporated elements that were recorded at a power plant that was just like the Chernobyl plant. They recorded sounds, just the sounds, and they manipulated those sounds in order to create the score. And it is so grounded at the same time as being otherworldly and haunting.
Yeah, John, that's something you and I talked about. One of these days, we got to talk about how people only listen to experimental music if it's in a movie soundtrack. But there's amazingly sophisticated stuff being done. All the stuff nobody would listen to in 20th century music, modern music or whatever. You put it in a Matrix score or whatever, and suddenly it's palatable.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, so we definitely need to revisit that. Andrew, anything recently?
I too was watching Chernobyl and loved it and found it to be exceptional. But no, the biggest thing that I've been working with or trying is I took my entire home entertainment and music system wireless this week. No cables except for power cables. And the fact that I can have a Bluetooth connection between my speakers and my television, and connection between subwoofer and speaker, record player, it's holy cow, it's amazing.
Okay, audiophiles will tell you that's inherently impossible.
They will, and they have, and it doesn't matter because it's living proof that it's possible. And not only is it possible, but I argue that I'm experiencing results that are superior to my wired setup.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to write about that, right?
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Looking forward to that. Dennis?
My latest obsession, and I think I'm probably late to the party on this, it's a YouTube channel called Smarter Every Day. It's this guy named Destin Sandlin, who's an aerospace engineer from Huntsville. And he makes these just incredible 5 to 10 minute videos on YouTube. And a lot of what he's doing is using 20,000 frame per second slow motion 4K cameras. And he's exploring concepts like fluid dynamics and laminar flow and what happens, what is the physics of what happens when two vortex rings collide and things like that. The difference between detonation and deflagration, and it's really nerdy stuff, but this guy is so excited about everything that you are just utterly entertained for 5 to 10 minutes, but you also just happen to learn something. And the footage that he's capturing and delivering in 4K by YouTube is genuinely some of the most compelling imagery that I've seen on anything anywhere in the past months. But so
he's authentic in presenting this. He doesn't think he needs to be a comedian to have an audience.
No. Right. And it actually just started out with him, shooting it on a smartphone, I want to show you this cool thing. Oh my God, it's the coolest thing in the world. And he just got a little bit of an audience and made a little more money and upgraded his gear. But it's really ultimately still rooted in what it originally was, which this guy is just so utterly fascinated by the natural world. And he wants everyone to be as excited about it as he is. And so he shares it in the most compelling way that he can imagine. And it is just truly captivating. So
great.
It's Smarter Every Day if anybody wants to check it out. But I highly recommend it. It's like Mr. Wizard wished that he could have been this compelling and entertaining. You know what I mean?
Okay, great. Any closing thoughts from anybody before I wrap it up? Okay. Very little of this went where I thought it was going to, but that was a good thing. So I hope people listening in agree. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, everybody.
Thank
And we'll talk to everybody again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, bye.